يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to another Middle East Analysis. Now, I'm delighted to say I do have our regular studio guest sitting opposite me with his ream of titles. That's Dr. Harry Hagopian, international lawyer, former Assistant General Secretary of the Middle East Council of Churches. All-round good bloke, got to add that as well. Harry, it's a pleasure to see you. How are you?
Hello, James. It is a pleasure to be here. It's very, very hot outside, and here we have a slightly cooler studio today.
Thank goodness. Now, we are going to do four podcasts. Sounds like a marathon, bear with me, but I think because we're talking four weighty issues with many, many countries across the Middle East, North Africa region, that is the way to do it.
I'll try and rise up to the occasion.
I know you will, and you are the man, actually, for this, for all of it, but particularly for this first section, which is Israel-Palestine. And obviously, with your experience 20 years ago in Oslo for the Oslo Accords, where, yeah, I can't believe it's 20 years, actually, but you were a second-track negotiator, weren't you, for Jerusalem in particular in those discussions?
I can't believe either that it's been 20 years, James, because I feel extremely old when you put it that way, that I was actually doing politics and negotiations 20 years ago. Yes, it was one of the pivotal moments politically for me within the Israeli-Palestinian context, and I think I went into those second-track negotiations on behalf of all the churches in Jerusalem, Orthodox, Catholic, and Anglican or Reform, both as a lawyer but also as an ecumenist who was there to make sure that all three faiths, as the former Latin Rite Patriarch used to say, the three faiths and the two peoples of the Holy Land were represented in what we thought then was a done deal and which later proved to be an undone deal.
Well, we have John Kerry, Secretary of State in the US, looking to a rather ambitious 9-month blueprint to find a way to peace. But are these not just talks about talks about talks about talks? I mean, are we getting anywhere with this? Is this another false dawn?
Oslo, when we were dealing with Oslo, we did not regard it as a false dawn, but then there is always wisdom with hindsight. And when we look at Oslo now, I do understand why Oslo fell through, why it didn't succeed, because it was not a balanced agreement. It was not one that would have been workable. But it was one at that time that generated a lot of discussion, again, a lot of writing. I wrote two papers on the legal sovereignty of Jerusalem and how to divide Jerusalem in terms of all the religious, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish realities in the city itself, let alone in that tiny little area called the Old City of Jerusalem. So there was expectation, there was hope, and then that disappeared. But the hope was even before that. For me, one of the key moments for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to be resolved was when James Baker was Secretary of State, who under Bush the father made every effort to try and bring Palestinians and Israelis together. And I remember the man going to St. George's Anglican Cathedral in Jerusalem. He was a devout Christian. He came from Texas, who sat there, prayed, and was almost in tears about the fact that those two peoples were not able to see what was staring them in the face, that we need a win-win solution rather than a win-lose solution, which is part of what the political narrative and discourse has been all about. And then we moved forward with the Madrid negotiations, we moved forward with the Geneva Initiative post the Oslo Accords, and now we've come to a situation where it's almost, to put it dramatically, because some people have put it like that, it's the last chance saloon. Is it the last chance saloon? I don't know. If you read people like Stephen Walt in the foreign policy, he would say that this will not hold together. If you read somebody like Gershon Baskin, who's co-chair of IPCRI in Jerusalem, if you read somebody like Rami Khoury, they would say it's very iffy, but I might just have a chance of succeeding. And I'll tell you my take on it, James, as somebody who's dirtied his hands quite a bit with this conflict. What we're talking about, you hit the nail on the head in a sense when you said talks about talks and discussions about discussions. The ones we saw on our television screens a few days ago were with Tzipi Livni and Saab Erekat alongside Shtayyeh and Molcho as advisors getting together to prepare some sort of a program about what they're going to talk about. Then the negotiations will continue either in Israel or within Palestine or the Palestinian territories. Now, everybody is making a full hoo-ha about those negotiations. I would actually break it down into three areas at least. The first is what we are witnessing, the negotiations. But for me, this is irrelevant. It does not warrant much emotional paroxysms or even much ink to be spilt on those. Why? Because every single negotiator worth his or her salt already knows after 20 or 30 years of working with this conflict, and most of the people who are together today are the same people who were there together 20 years ago. It means they know each other pretty well. They know the issues even better. So the negotiations are not going to create any fireworks that will suddenly say, wow, we discovered the Holy Grail today, which we'd missed 20 years ago during Oslo, during Geneva, during Madrid, during the other stations of this political process. So for me, negotiations is basically just rehashing old arguments and each side trying to pull the argument a little bit to his or her side. So it's more of a political tug of war in order to bring together a blueprint, which would be yet again, if you want to use another one of those blasé terms, another roadmap that would actually be the solution to the conflict. Okay, that's it. Now we come to the serious bit. The serious bit is not the negotiation. Saab Erekat and Tzipi Livni and all the others can sit there and talk about this for 9 months. They can talk every day or they can talk once weekly. We know what the issues are. We know what the Clinton parameters are. We know what the Arab Peace Initiative is. We know what it takes to sue for peace or forge a peace solution to Israel and Palestine. But the second point, which is the important point, is the implementation or the decision-making. What has been lacking in the Israeli-Palestinian context is not clever and able negotiators putting together the issues, the core issues, the final status issues, whether it's Jerusalem, whether it is the issue of refugees, Palestinian refugees from 1948 and 1967, whether it is issues to do with the final borders, whether it is to do with water and natural resources. They know all this. They can recite it to you like poetry. What needs to be done is for the decision makers, and particularly at this stage, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and PA President Mahmoud Abbas, to have the political guts, the gumption, to say, we're going to implement this. Do they think they have enough confidence and ability and strength to do that? So the point really is what comes after the 9 months and after the negotiations. Will the leaders be able to implement what the negotiators would recommend? Because what does that mean? That means you have to make sure that the two key people are going to say yes and then put it to a public referendum, which, if dealt with positively, both the Palestinians and Israelis, I believe, would approve. But this is also where the Americans are important and where John Kerry is important. Not so much in stewarding those 9 months as Martin Indyk is going to do as special envoy now on those talks, but as trying to keep both sides on track and making them actually come up and implement those decisions. This is the second phase, but I'm not over yet. because post the second phase will come the third phase, which is the most important phase, much more than the implementation. Let us suppose, you and I, that the negotiators say to Netanyahu and Abbas, this is what we propose, we're happy with it. Let us assume that Netanyahu and Abbas will say, okay, let's go for it. Here are the public referenda. We have a peace process. Is that the end of the process? No, it's the beginning of the process, because the real question is, would it stick? Would it stay together, or would it fritter away? Would it be a win-win solution where both peoples would feel that they've been vindicated, or would it be one that was done under duress, in which case it will start splintering at the edges, then at the heart, and therefore what needs to go into this is risk management procedures that would keep it coherent and cohesive as a package deal that the both peoples agreed to, but also, and very importantly, one whereby the peoples of both countries, Palestine and Israel, would agree to. And one of the problems of the Oslo process, where it fell down, is the fact that there weren't enough people-to-people contacts, which is what really makes the difference in building up faith, in consolidating peace. And it was almost thrown in at the last minute, and it was too late to make a difference. So for me, it's negotiations, implementation, and then how do we make this workable? And those are increasingly and incrementally more important steps.
And that, I think, is the point. It's almost like the negotiators aren't just speaking. We talked about knocking two heads together, but it's almost like two heads of a hydra, isn't it? Once you two get to take it on, you then sell it to those in positions of authority, who then crucially have to sell it to the people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I can sit here and bore you to death with story after story, some of it unpublished, about what happened during the Oslo negotiations, which shows it's a question of who's negotiating, who's doing what, who is talking, who takes the decision, who makes sure that the decision actually sticks and holds together. This is what matters most. So when you take all of this together, and we discussed this, Bishop Declan and I, with the Israeli ambassador and with the Palestinian mission representative, the question is not so much, oh, let's sit and negotiate. For crying out loud, it's been done for 20 years and the situation hasn't changed enough to warrant new fireworks. What needs to be done is the good faith and the goodwill to implement those decisions, and then do it in such a way that both peoples feel that they took something out of it. They will never get everything they want on any of the core issues, but this has to move forward, particularly in a MENA region that is truly, truly enveloped in a dust of uncertainties.
Well, you can speak Hebrew and Arabic. Why don't we send you, Harry?
Well, I will be there at some stage.
Now, just to conclude, probably right to point out at this moment in time that Bishop Declan and the Anglican Bishop of Exeter as well, the two of them visited Israel's ambassador to the UK not so long ago, and a statement was released that I thought was pretty firm, but it was sort of a now is the time for action, and we've talked about the pros and cons of that. So there are many voices, aren't there, encouraging this to be the time to actually come together and sort something out.
Absolutely. And the Israeli ambassador, Daniel Tobe, is a very, very resourceful and experienced negotiator. He's been very much involved with the frameworks of the Oslo Accords, and he's done much, much more than that. And we basically discussed with him some of the positions we have about how we can have Israelis and Palestinians put together a win-win rather than a win-lose solution to this long-running and festering conflict.
Now, for a final thought, Harry, I'm going to direct you towards a sad piece of news that we received in the last few days about a man who was most certainly very much a friend to the Holy Land. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, it is a sad thought, and I just learnt about it yesterday, actually, James. It's Michael Whelan. Michael Whelan, who used to be a Knight of the Order of the Holy Sepulchre, and then he became chair of something called Friends of the Holy Land, which basically has nothing to do with politics. If anything, I think they used to shy away from being political, and they wanted basically to support the people of the Holy Land, Christians, of course, because that is the remit of the organization, but also across the board with all sorts of initiatives, whether it's a day clinic somewhere or whether it is something else, in order to try and help the grassroots in the Holy Land. Unfortunately, Michael Whelan passed away, and he's a big loss because he was a friend to the Holy Land, and he will be sorely missed. I sent a little note of condolences yesterday to one of the committee members, and his answer was quite nice. He said, if anything, we should redouble our efforts to bring peace and prosperity to the Holy Land as one of the legacies that Michael Whelan started himself. So a sad moment indeed.
A fine man, and will certainly be missed. Harry, thank you for now. This is the first of four action-packed podcasts on the Middle East North Africa region. So that was our discussion on Israel and Palestine. Join us for part two, which is going to be a discussion on the turmoil of Egypt.